Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Greg Raymer, 2004 World Series of Poker main event winner. We'll be talking to Greg in a few minutes. An email sent to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Richard received a question there that he's answered on this show before, more than once. Still, since not all our listeners catch every show, we'll have Richard address it again. Seems like this particular listener says he's a pretty good card counter and is considering moving to Vegas to be close to the action. Richard, do you think this would be a good move?
The short answer is no. As I've said many times on the show, Las Vegas right now is probably the worst place in the United States for a card counter. They are very quick to pick you off, and because there is so much consolidation between the two big companies, Caesars and MGM, they're very quick to disseminate your picture all over town. So for any kind of stakes, Vegas is a bad place. This particular writer, listener, was from the Chicagoland area, and there are plenty of casinos in the Chicagoland area. I would stay there unless you want to move for other reasons. But moving to Vegas just to count cards, I think, is a really bad idea.
All right. Moving to Hawaii would be worse. But but maybe better for other reasons. On my blog last week, which may be found on gamblingwithanedge.com, I spoke of a player I called Joe who wanted to hire me as a mentor. This guy was basically an intelligent beginner. Without recounting the entire blog, I told the guy to learn two games really well, specifically 9-6 Jacks or better and NSU Deuces Wild, and spend 30 hours or more over 2 weeks playing these games in a casino. Then come back to me and talk to me if he still wanted to do this. If he says he's still interested and passes a test on these games, I'll probably work with him. I basically got this idea from making sure the guy was serious from Richard, who says he uses a similar approach when players ask him for mentoring. Richard, what do you do?
Well, it used to be people would just ask me to teach them how to count cards. And so I would tell them to learn basic strategy backwards and forwards and in your sleep and come back. 99% of them never come back. The few who do come back and say, you know, I've learned basic strategy. I ask them a few questions, you know, usually involving how they play A7 versus various up cards. And almost none of them ever have learned basic strategy perfectly. So really that stopped. But now, since the game has become about much more than just counting cards, I do get requests for mentoring, and I kind of turn them, almost all of them, down just because I'm sort of mentoring my son, for one, and two, I just don't want to be in that position. I feel like, I don't know, it's just not something I'm really interested in doing.
Okay,
but
good.
Most people don't put in the effort anyway, so it hasn't really been much of a problem.
Now, a very insightful comment to that blog was made by Frank B., who has guested on this show several times. He says the guy already had a pretty big bankroll. In the blog, we said it was $2 million. And many guys who make it as a pro really struggle in the early days seeking plus EV. Since this guy already has a bankroll, he might not go through this process, which Frank B. believes is a critical part of the development of a strong player. His words rang true to me personally. I can't tell you how many of the 7-for-5 or 10-for-5 match play coupons I cashed in the early 90s. And I spent lots of times figuring out how this particular promotion was worth an extra 15 cents an hour, or that enhancement to the rule was another 10 cents an hour. I haven't cashed one of those coupons this millennium. And I don't worry about 15 cents an hour anymore, but I still have the ability to analyze a promotion to that degree. I think it helped me to be what I am today. Richard?
I would agree, and I would also say, if you have a $2 million bankroll, why would you want to go out and grind? Because playing video poker or table games with an edge is a grind. But with that kind of bankroll, I think you can have a fabulous lifestyle and play with an edge, but without having to worry about actually making money. In other words, start exploiting the comp system. So the actual cash in pocket that you're going to earn may not be that high, but if you factor in the comps, you know, it's a pretty good way to go.
I actually do both.
Yeah.
I grind and I enjoy the comps. All right. Let's talk to our guest. Greg Raymer began his 15 minutes of fame, which hasn't ended yet, back in 2004 when he won the main event of the World Series of Poker. Many of us have a permanent memory that he had these weird lizard eyeball glasses and he used a fossil as a card protector. Greg Raymer, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on the show.
Yeah, I was thinking about you on the most recent Saturday Night Live. Octavia Spencer was wearing those glasses.
Yeah, I just saw that on DVR last night. So I have to say, greatest prop in the history of SNL.
Now, do you own a piece of those glasses?
Not at all. I mean, I don't even know who makes them. It is the kind of thing that, you know, is probably produced, you know, like somewhere in Asia, real cheap. It's a novelty item. It's not meant to be a serious thing. It's essentially those kind of like John Lennon style glasses, you know, so you got these flat round lenses, which aren't really appropriate. They're sunglasses, they're dark sunglasses, and then they've stuck a hologram sticker on them. And that's the reason they use that type, because if the sticker is going to adhere, it has to be a flat surface. But if it's a flat surface, that's really not good eyewear. So you would not want to sit there and wear glasses like that all day long. It could actually harm your vision if you did that. I didn't realize it at the time when I was using them way back then, but I would only put them on when I was in the hand. And as soon as the hand was over, I'd take them off. So until I entered the next pot that I chose to play, I would not be wearing them. So fortunately, I wasn't wearing them all day. I wasn't going to hurt my eyesight.
Do you still use them now just because it's become a thing?
No, I mean, people ask a lot. And what's really funny to me is I will have someone who comes up to me, let's say like at the grocery store. I'm sitting there pushing my cart, you know, buying, you know, bread and bananas and milk and whatever. And they're like, hey, I know you. Where are your glasses? You know, like, and they seem to honestly feel like, how come you're not wearing those, like, right now? And it's like, why would I be wearing something like that, you know, when I'm eating out or at the grocery store or walking through the airport or whatever else, you know, just.
Yeah.
That would just be like someone who's begging for attention, not, you know, there's no purpose to it. But the truth is, those are dark sunglasses, and I actually do not wear them at all anymore because it's real easy to misread the cards. You know, the dealer puts a card out in the middle of the table. You know, you're a few feet away in your seat. If you're wearing dark sunglasses, unless it's a very well-lit room, you might misread the card, and I made that mistake where I thought, you know, a five was a six. So, you know, I learned my lesson. Fortunately, I didn't have to pay the price on that hand. But, you know, I learned the lesson on that hand. And so I stopped wearing them if it wasn't well lit. And now I don't wear them at all. When I want to cover my eyes, I actually work with a company called Blue Shark Optics. And they make glasses that are designed especially for poker. So they have a special coating that it looks like a mirrored sunglass from the outside, where you're seeing that reflection of things and you're not seeing the eyes. But the coating is such that it reflects just enough to create that mirror image effect, but it does not diminish the amount of light getting to your eyes, so you still see everything just fine.
this main event was over a decade ago.
Yep.
And to date, it's the defining moment of your life. So that's what everybody wants to talk to you about, I guess, including us. Now, it's technically possible you could become president or maybe a serial killer for that matter, and that'll eclipse what you've already done. But probably you know it's likely that your obituary several decades off is going to start off with Greg Raymer, winner of $5 million in the 2004 World Series of Poker, was killed today when an automobile he was driving went all in against an 18-wheeler, and he suffered the ultimate bad beat. Now, it's already been written. How do you deal with answering the same questions over and over and over again?
Well, I mean, everyone who's asking, you know, is asking for a reason. They haven't heard the answer, and they think it's of interest to their audience. So whether it's for a written, like a newspaper type thing, you know, a written thing, or whether it's like this where it's going to be audio. And so, you know, I just try to give them the same honest answer. You know, obviously I'm not going to say word for word exact same thing every time, even if I wanted to. But I just try to, you know, give the person what they're looking for. And it's the same idea, you know, fans come up to me and it's not an interview, it's not being published, and they're asking the same questions. And it's the same thing. It's like, okay, this guy doesn't know that answer. Let's just tell him the answer. And, you know, give him what he wants. I mean, being famous, you know, even though I'm not, you know, it's not like I'm Matt Damon, you know, and Justin Bieber and you know, that level of fame and celebrity. But I'm still going to get recognized, you know, upwards of 100 times if I spend the day, like if I go to with my family to Walt Disney World. So, you know, even though I'm not on their level, it's still something that happens fairly frequently when I'm out in public. And almost all the people are nice, pleasant, and almost all of them, you know, are just being honest and straightforward. And so I'll, you know, try to give them what they want to the extent I have time to do so.
We should point out that you are a serious player with a very good track record. This was not a one-hit wonder when you won the World Series. So,
no, it wasn't portrayed like that. I mean, if you watch that, you know, rewatch the old footage from 04 that ESPN played, they were looking for another Chris Moneymaker story. So they kind of portrayed me as much like that as they could without, you know, being dishonest. And, you know, so they kept telling, you know, he's an amateur, he's an attorney, he's not a professional. But the truth is I could have quit my job as an attorney and made a living as a poker player for many years before I won the main event. But I probably wouldn't have made a better living. And, you know, I had a wife, a daughter, a mortgage. You know, it didn't make sense to take the risk and to give up all that money, you know, to make less money with no benefits didn't really make any sense. And I was able to play a lot as a part-time professional player. And I filed my taxes as a part-time professional poker player. And I never had a losing year, you know, so I've been playing for 12 years, never had a losing year when I won the main event. And it was probably my 500th live tournament, give or take, when I won the main event. Whereas Chris Moneymaker, it was his first live tournament ever. So they tried to put me in that shoebox, so to speak, to make me look more like Chris because it had played so well the year before. But yeah, the truth was, you know, I wasn't that beginner amateur type thing they were looking for.
Right. So currently, what percentage, how much of your time is spent playing tournaments versus cash games versus online play?
Well, I don't play online at all and haven't since Black Friday, when the major sites got shut down and kicked out of the United States. So, you know, you can play online poker in the U.S. now, anywhere in the U.S. on a handful of sites that do business, you know, and they're headquartered overseas, and so whether they're illegal or not, which personally I actually would like to argue that they're not illegal under any federal law, but certainly if they were located physically within the U.S., they would have been shut down by now.
Other than Nevada, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Yeah, those three states have legal sites that are headquartered in those three states, and you can play legally and openly and all that, on, if you have to be physically present within those three states to play on those sites. And then, but I don't live in those three states, so I can't play on those. And I choose not to play on the other sites, mostly because the games on those sites are not really the games that interest me. When I play cash games, I much prefer to play what we might refer to as the mixed games. So instead of playing No Limit Hold'em or maybe PLO, Pot Limit Omaha, I really prefer the limit games, and I especially prefer the draw games and the stud games. And these other sites that are operating within the U.S. right now, they either don't offer those games at all, or those games are offered, but they never go, or they only go at the very micro stakes, you know, when you're playing for less than a dollar size bets. Whereas, like, you know, in the past, I could play on PokerStars, and I could play 30, 60 mixed games and stuff like that. So now you're talking games where, you know, you might be a, you know, if you're one of the better players in the game, you might be making 50, 100 or more dollars an hour. But if you're playing 25 cent, 50 cent limit poker, you could crush the game and still only make $5 an hour.
Right.
So, sorry about that. It's the home phone ringing.
Okay. Guess you can't do anything about it. Now, earlier, Richard and I talked about turning away players who wanted mentoring. Surely you get requests for people who want you to teach them poker lessons.
Yes.
Do you ever do you turn them away ever, and why?
Well, I have to turn most of them away. I mean, to be honest, the truth is my rate for private lessons is expensive enough that most people, you know, who want like a mentoring type thing, who want that ongoing relationship, it's probably not, you know, it's just not justifiable cost-wise. I mean, the most recent example was a guy who wanted to start doing some private lessons. But, you know, he's playing 1-2 no limit hold'em, wants to move up to 2-5 no limit. And if he's doing well at 2-5, taking a one-hour lesson with me is going to cost him, you know, 2 days' profits or more. So it just doesn't, you know, it's not cost-effective. There's better ways for him to improve his game in terms of what he's gaining versus what he pays for that gain. I do a lot of group things. Like, I have an event coming up at the Canterbury Park Poker Room in Minnesota in April. And that's $300 for a full day, like 8-hour seminar with me, 8-hour event. But you're one of, you know, 30, 40, 50 students for that. Whereas, you know, private lesson, we're talking a similar price like that per hour. So now it's just hard for you to justify that. Unless you're playing bigger. Most of the students I've given private lessons to, it's kind of a one-off thing, like a guy who's made day two or day three of the main event. And so he has that day off and he wants to, you know, like take a 1 or 2 hour lesson with me to improve his chances now that he's actually, you know, beaten out a significant part of the field.
What advice do you give to those people, the ones who really can't, it doesn't make financial sense to, you know, step into those private lessons? But, you know, the guy who's playing 1-2 that wants to step up to the next level or 2-5, what advice do you give them?
Well, I tell him I'll be happy to give him lessons. It's just that, again, I tell him, you know, it's probably not cost effective and that he would be better off taking that same money and spending it on other means of improving his game, and I'll tell him what some of those suggestions might be. You know, books he can read, websites he can go to that, you know, there's lots of poker training websites where you pay like a monthly fee, $20, $30 a month, and you have unlimited access to their training videos and other tools. So there, I mean, you know, he can buy a 1 hour lesson from me, or he can buy a 1 year subscription to a website like that.
And are there any of those that you would recommend to our audience? Because, you know, a lot of our audience are, this comes up for us a lot, where people who were card counters or video poker players want to learn to play poker with an edge and actually make money at it.
It's tougher in many ways, though, to do that in poker. I mean, in video poker and in blackjack, It all comes down to math.
Exactly.
The only non-math element is your ability to disguise that you're a card counter. I mean, in video poker, there is nothing. I mean, as far as I know, that's not an issue. I have friends who play video poker with an edge, and there doesn't seem to be an issue of them ever getting barred or being denied the comp, you know, the slot club benefits or any of that. Maybe it does happen, but it does happen. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm always surprised because, I mean, I don't even understand, like, why would they give me benefits? The machine can tell them, you know, how I'm playing and what edge they have against me. And if they're like, wow, this guy's getting the full 99.8% return on this machine because he's playing it basically perfect, be like, why would we comp him anything?
Well, fortunately, currently the machine can't tell them that yet. That day is coming.
Well, that just means no one's put the software in because it's obviously something that, you know, you'd hire a couple of programmers and they could put it in place with no big... I mean, they don't have to invent anything.
Right.
To enable the machines to do that kind of tracking. I'm surprised they don't. Because, again, like, why comp somebody, you know, more than he's losing to you? I mean, I understand it's pretty hard to find video poker games that you can actually win at without, like, having the comp, you know, the slot club card. You know, you can just beat them outright. I think those machines are very rare to non-existent nowadays. I'm not an expert in this area. You guys are.
They do exist in Las Vegas for low stakes, and the casinos do punish you for playing them.
Okay. And, you know, whereas the friends I know that do it, a lot of them are poker pros. But then what they do is they play video poker fairly big, where the benefits outweigh their expected losses. And it's kind of like, well, I already want to be in this casino because I'm here for the poker tournament. And I want to, you know, have the hotel room and I'm going to eat. And now I will use my slot club benefits to pay for the hotel room and the food. And so I will save expenses of $1,000 and lose $400 playing video poker doing so.
Yeah.
And so they're that kind of dynamic. You know, whereas if you had a regular job and were playing video poker on the side, it's kind of like, oh, you know, maybe you can convert that $1,000 in hotel and food credit to cash, but now they're going to give you $500 cash, not $1,000. So now all of a sudden you're making so little, you know, it may not be worth your time unless you just enjoy doing it. But in any event, the big difference in poker, of course, is that you can never know what your edge is. You know, if I'm playing video poker, you know, yes, maybe I'm making some mistakes and I'm playing so quickly I'm not aware of it in the moment and I don't realize my edge isn't as big as I thought. But in poker, it's not that. I mean, in poker, it's not just what's the perfect, like, scientific play, but it's things like, you know, reading the player and stuff like that, or just... Even if I'm playing game theory optimal poker, which no one knows what that is yet, it hasn't been solved, but even if you had that solution somehow, you still wouldn't know what your edge is because your edge would depend on, like, how far away are these guys that I'm competing against? How far are they from game theory optimal? How many mistakes are they making? The closer they are to game theory optimal, the less money I'm making. And how do I determine that to know what my edge is? And is it a big enough edge to overcome the house rake, and is it enough edge that it's worth my time, or should I quit this game and find a better one? So even though a lot of poker strategy does come down to math, you also have to have all these other skills to be successful. And, you know, you can't be sure. You may think you're playing a winning game when you're not.
So what books do you recommend? I mean, you know, 20 years ago, there were so few books, everybody had the same answer, right? Get Theory of Poker and Doyle's book. What books currently do you recommend to people that are trying to, you know, improve their game?
Well, I mean, the number one pick is actually still The Theory of Poker. If you haven't read any poker books, that's the one I'm going to tell you to read. I still think that's the most valuable. Most of the books out there are talking about a specific game. You know, they're saying this is how to beat a no-limit hold'em cash game. This is how to beat a tournament. This is how to win at stud. And they will mention these issues that are relevant to every form of poker because it's relevant to their game that they're discussing with you. Whereas the theory of poker does not pretend to teach you how to be any good at hold'em or stud or Omaha or any specific game. He just teaches you a lot of the basic concepts that are going to apply to every game. And if you really understand the basic concepts, then I could make up a new poker game, tell you the rules, and you could, you know, better than the rest of us, presumably, figure out correct strategy because you understand all the basic concepts so well. And that's the way I like to do things and learn things, you know, when I was a student in college and we're, you know, taking classes in physics and organic chemistry and whatnot. I didn't want to just like memorize formulas. I wanted to understand what was going on and why. And once I had that understanding, you know, now I can figure out in the middle of, you know, I can forget a formula in the middle of the exam and figure the formula out because I have the basic knowledge of the underlying science. And that's the way I like to teach and approach poker is let's teach big concepts and make sure you really understand them at a deep level. And then you can figure out the nitty-gritty details on the fly.
Okay, so theory of poker, are there any others?
Well, I haven't read all of his books, but the Dan Harrington books I've read are excellent, and I've never heard bad stuff about the other ones, so any of the Harrington books are good. And I also think highly of Jonathan Little, and he's published a whole bunch of different poker books as well. So I haven't, again, I haven't read all of his books, but I have no reason to think those aren't all worthwhile. I have a tournament book, but it isn't out yet. Hopefully I'll get it out here in the not too distant future. So obviously I'm going to recommend that one. And again, it's very conceptual. So some of the teachings will apply beyond tournament poker, but also to cash games and so on. But, you know, really it's an issue of how do you learn well? Some people don't learn well reading books. For me, that works quite well. As a student, it was like, skip classroom, just let me read the book. And then I'll show up at class every now and then and ask questions for things that I wasn't sure I understood fully. Other people, they want that lecture of going to the classroom. Other people want, like, the videos. They, you know, they do training videos, and that's really how they learn. So it's also a question of figuring out what works best for you personally as a way of learning.
And, you know, I didn't get the answer before. What percentage of your time is spent playing cash games versus tournaments nowadays?
It's been highly focused on tournaments the last several years, mostly because I live here in Raleigh, North Carolina. There's no poker near here. So I don't, you know, when I'm home, I'm home. When I travel, I'm usually traveling to events. You know, I don't take a trip somewhere just to play cash games. So I'm going somewhere because it's the World Series in Vegas over the summer, because it's a Heartland Poker Tour event or a WSOP circuit event or something like that. And so I'm there primarily for the tournaments, and I play cash games if I have extra time and nothing else to do. But even then, sometimes I don't really play the cash games because I'm not that interested in No Limit Hold'em as a cash game. I don't think it's a very good cash game. I think Limit Hold'em is a much better cash game for 98-99% of the people. And I especially prefer the draw games and the stud games, but most places now, you never find those games. They're just never available. So, I mean, I've worked a lot, for example, with Daytona Beach Kennel Club. They have over 50 poker tables. I've been there when they're full spread. Every single table has got a cash game going, and yet they will have one or two tables playing some Omaha, and everything else is Hold'em. And that's it. And you'd be like, wow, like 50 different tables, and there's not a single stud game, you know? And hey, we're in Florida. There are a lot of retirees. You know, stud was a more popular game back in the day. You'd think people of retirement age would be that much more likely to be stud players. And yet, even though they have lots of retired people who play there, there's still no stud game ever at that location that I'm aware of. So, you know, I mean, they've either never had a stud game or they've had it so rarely it isn't worth noting. And but those are the games I prefer. So, you know, I might be someplace, I'm out of the tournament for the day. It's like, okay, I'll be back tomorrow for the next tournament or the next day one. But rather than like spend the next 4 or 5 hours playing No Limit Hold'em Cash Game, I'll just go back to my room and either get some work done or watch, you know, watch a movie on my computer. So
when you're coming out here, I assume, for the World Series in a few months.
Yep. Absolutely.
Do you play the Seven Stud and the Horse event and all the?
Oh yeah, that's the reason I come out for the whole thing. Pretty much every year I've been there from, you know, day one or day two, you know, end of May, beginning of June, and then I'm there until I'm done with the main event. So I'm there for the 6-7 weeks period, that whole entire period, and that's one of the reasons, is because it's about the only time all year when you can play a stud tournament and a draw tournament and a mixed game tournament and a dealer's choice and things that are not just No Limit Hold'em. So I come out because I really do want to play all those other events, and if I have extra time, you know, then I can find, you know, cash games where they're playing the mixed games and we're playing Badoogie and Deuce to Seven and Badesi and all those other games that a lot of people have never even heard of.
But no trips, because you can find those pretty much year-round here in Vegas. You don't make any special trips out just to play for a while.
For really high stakes against the best players.
Well, I've never played, like, you know, the 1,000, 2,000, and 4,000, 8,000, and those types of games. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, I consider myself a really good poker player, but I don't consider myself to be the best in the world. And so why do I want to sit down and play for super high stakes, you know, where everyone or almost everyone at the table is a world-class player? You know, the edge that the best player can ever have in those games is not that big. And then the variance then goes through the roof. I mean, the reason I became a poker player, when I had been a card counter, and I had been going to the University of Minnesota, and at the time, the tribal casinos, you could play the blackjack games there, and they just had no heat. Literally no heat. I mean, I saw a guy who would vary his bet from 5 to 500, and you could hear him mumbling the count under his breath, and they didn't care. He eventually got kicked out because of abusive behavior, because he would lose his temper when he lost his bigger bets and do things like throw cards at the dealer and stuff. And they kicked him out for that, not because he was counting. I didn't have the bankroll to play big. I averaged $7 an hour, but that was like more than double minimum wage back then. So it was just a good student job, so to speak. You know, I could choose my own hours and make extra money. But then when I finished and became an attorney in Chicago, I went to the riverboat games that they had at the time. And, you know, it was like 8 decks, and they were shuffling with, like, you know, half the shoe. They would shuffle after like 4 decks. The rules weren't that good. And I had some software where I could input my counting method and the rules and have it run millions of hands simulation. And I had gone to one of those boats, you know, to make sure I knew their rules and penetration and everything, input that information in my software that night, and started it running. And maybe, you know, an hour or two later, I'm about to go to bed, and I looked at it, and it had played about a million hands at that point, and I was losing. Like, you know, I stuck like $40,000 theoretically. And I'm like, oh, well, that sucks. I guess I can't beat that game. But I let it run overnight. When I got up in the morning, it was like, oh, look at this. You know, I ended up averaging like $40 an hour after 10 million hands. But I was losing after the first million. And I was just like, wow. I mean, I was thinking I'll do this part-time to make extra money. But, you know, going and playing once or twice a week, I might spend the rest of my life before I hit a million hands.
Right.
And so it was kind of like, well, why would I do this if I could go play perfect with an advantage and still be a loser at the end of my life? You know, the variance was so much higher than the edge that it wasn't worth doing. And that's when I found poker and started doing that.
About 6 months ago, after your World Series of Poker win, you were playing at a Bellagio tournament and had an interesting incident with two men named Kevin Joy and Dean Kasem. What happened?
Well, it was, like I said, it was like half a year after I'd won back in late December 04. I was at the Bellagio for one of the World Poker Tour events, and I'd been out of the tournament, had been playing high-stakes cash games every night, you know, until 2 or 3 in the morning, mostly playing like 300, 600 mixed games. So that's a game where you should be prepared to, you know, put 20, 30,000 on the table, you know, in an evening. And my last night there, I had gone to the safe deposit box, and every night before that, I'd go there and put my money away for the night. And, you know, the next day, I'd get up when I was going to play and stop by and grab some chips out of this thing. And there was also a thing back then, we had thought this was acceptable. Now it isn't. But I knew some people that actually had like legal opinions. You know, they'd gone to lawyers to get an opinion saying that if you traveled overseas out of, you know, in and out of the U.S. with casino chips, they didn't have to be declared. People may be aware of you. You can travel within the U.S. having all the cash you want. And there's no legal reason you can't travel with as much cash as you would like. But if you leave or enter the U.S. with more than $10,000, you have to declare it. You're allowed to do it. You can take, again, you want to take $1 billion cash, you know, with you, feel free, but just don't forget to declare it. If you declare it, it's all legal. If you don't declare it, now you're breaking a law. And people didn't like the hassle. And so someone had, you know, gotten this legal opinion and shared it with us that like, oh, look, my attorney said if it's a casino chip, like a Bellagio chip has no value anywhere but inside the Bellagio. It doesn't fit the definition of a monetary instrument under this law. So if you have $100,000 worth of Bellagio chips on you when you leave the U.S., you don't have to declare it. So I had converted all this money into these $5,000 Bellagio chips because I was going to do some overseas travel. And at the time, and probably still today, you take a Bellagio 5K chip with you to Europe, there's always a player that's happy to buy it for it from you. And he'll give you the fair exchange rate, you know, in the local currency. And so that night, because I had to check out early in the morning the next day, I had emptied my box. So instead of depositing this money in my box, I took those chips with me and then got the rest of them out and had over $100,000 in Bellagio chips with me. And then as I was getting into my room on the 20th floor of the Bellagio, those two guys jumped me, tried to rob me. And I was able to fight them off, and they went running away. And they got away from the casino that night, got caught a few months later in San Diego, you know, brought back to Vegas, and plea bargained their way and went to jail for a few years.
Now, did they have a gun when they jumped you?
Well, what had happened is when I got off the elevator, there's three hallways. So you can like go straight ahead or turn left or right. So I turned left down my wing, and there's a guy already in the hallway walking, you know, down the hall ahead of me, like 30 feet ahead. And you don't think any of that. That's perfectly natural. Like he'd been on some other elevator. You know, he got off his elevator, you know, a few seconds before you did, and he's heading to his room. My room was the last room on the right. This guy walked all the way to the second to the last room, you know, was fishing in his pocket for a couple seconds and then starts banging on the door, yelling a woman's name, saying, hey, you know, let me in. You know, forgot my key. And I go up and open my door. And so he's there, you know, on the side of my vision, standing to my right. And all of a sudden, someone else, a third person, is grabbing me from behind just as I've unlocked my door. And then this guy to my right jumps in, and they're both trying to push me into the room. Now, the guy banging on the door, not a big guy. You know, I'm 5'11 and well over 300 pounds. And don't look at me. Most people think I weigh a lot less than I do. So a lot of guys that are heavy, you know, they still have like thin legs, thin arms. You know, and it's all in their belly. Most of my extra weight's not in my belly. And, you know, so much stronger than most guys. Now, the guy who grabbed me from behind, he was actually taller than me, and he was big. But, again, he was that more stereotype, you know, skinny legs and arms, but a big gut. And so even with the two of them pushing, you know, I was able to push us back and out of the room and knock them away from me. And I'd been yelling for help as soon as they grabbed me. And then they're both standing there, like, my back is in the direction of the elevator. Their backs, you know, is the end of the hallway, a little bit behind them. And then the small guy had this bag in his hand, and he reached in and pulled out a gun. So I stopped yelling at that point and was staring at him for just like maybe 2 seconds. And I'm thinking, you know, they're not just trying to grab my money and run. They were trying to push me in my room. They're like going to tie me up, you know, and rob me. And, you know, if they get me in there tied up, they're going to be like, well, this guy's seen our faces. Like, we don't want him to identify us to the police. If they decide now that they've got me all tied up that they're going to kill me, I figure I'm 100% dead. Whereas if I just keep fighting out here in the hallway, even if they shoot me, if they do shoot, they'll probably run away, and most gunshot victims live. So I thought
this is a lot of calculation going on in a very short time.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, this was at most 2 seconds of thinking, but this is what went through my mind, was basically my best chance of living is to keep fighting. So after that second or two of contemplation, I start yelling for help again. Instead of the small guy shooting me, the big guy tries to grab me again. That was my big mistake, though. He came at me, and I, like, knocked him to the ground. And as soon as I did that, I was like, oh, you idiot, now you're going to get shot. Wow. Like, I should have held onto him and grappled with him so that his friend doesn't want to shoot, maybe, because he's, you know, doesn't know who he's going to hit. And I went to look up at the little guy thinking I'm about to get shot, and he isn't there anymore where he'd been standing. And I'm like, you know, and I can see the end of the hallway, you know. And I turn my head to the left, and he's not to the side of me. And it's like, oh, he's running down the hall. He gave up. He's running away. And then the big guy got up, and he started running after him with a limp because I guess I twisted his ankle or something when he went down. And then the adrenaline really kicked in. And I took about 3 or 4 steps running after them where I was shouting. And you might have to edit this out for your show. I don't know. But I'm like, I'm going to kill you motherfuckers. You know, I screamed that out, and then I was like, wait a second, I don't really want to catch them. They've got a gun. And at that point, now I see 2 security guards running up the hallway towards us. So I yelled out to the guards that, like, hey, they tried to rob me. They've got a gun. The guards let them go by, which I later learned is what they're supposed to do. You know, if you show a weapon or threaten a weapon or anything like that, then, like, there's no physical involvement. It's just let you go. But they're on their radio thing and immediately, you know, telling the rest of security. And so they had these guys on film later in the elevator lobby downstairs, running through the casino into the park, self park, and get in their car and drive away before the cops show up. But like I said, then they got caught a while later and ended up going to jail for a while.
That's an amazing story. Were you an athlete when you were younger?
I was one of the actually highest ranked racquetball players in Missouri when I was in high school. So I wasn't good enough to, like, really realistically consider going pro or anything at it, but I was still, I was probably the best, like, under 18 player in the state or close to it. And I was one of the top ranked amateurs of any age in St. Louis and Missouri at one point. And St. Louis was actually the city where racquetball was invented, so it was probably the toughest place to compete in that regard anyways. So I don't look like a racquetball player, and I didn't even look like one then. You know, they're usually, like, skinny and fast. And I was never fast. Even when I was in great shape back then, you know, I mean, I could go to the racquetball court by myself and practice and train for 6 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, and stuff. But, you know, I was never fast. People called me sneaky fast because, like, man, he doesn't move fast, but he always seems to be in the right place. And again, that was kind of like my ability to read people. I mean, I would gauge, you know, by little clues of your body language, you know, you had barely started your backswing and I'd already figured out where you were planning on hitting the ball. So I was already moving to where the ball was going to go before you had even started your downswing.
Back in 2004, and during the main event, when the final 9 were determined, everybody went and got some sleep, and then they started in the very next day.
Yes.
Now they take 4 months off and they come out and it's called the November 9th, which is held in October in election years, but it's still the November 9th. Do you think this November 9th is good for the main event, or do you like the way it was done in the old days?
Well, certainly it's overall to my advantage to do it the old way.
But,
it turned out that way, but I mean, even now, I'm pretty sure if I make the final nine this year, my chances of winning probably decline because of the delay. Because anyone who is, you know, less experienced and less knowledgeable now has more time to try to make up for that. So it's still not to my advantage personally. But the reason they started it like 9 years ago was TV ratings. You know, this was a huge surprise hit in 2003 when ESPN first did this full coverage of the main event and Chris Moneymaker won. It was tremendously more popular than they ever had hoped. And then the ratings got even bigger and the reruns more common in 2004 when I won. And then ratings dropped off in 2005, dropped off more in 2006, more in 2007. And they were looking for a way to reverse that trend, and they came up with the idea of the November 9. And ratings did improve the next year, the first time they did the November 9. So in that sense, it's a good idea. I mean, if it's what made the difference and increased the ratings, then I think it was overall worthwhile for poker to do it that way. And obviously, it's neutral. I mean, it's not like the November 9 was created because, okay, Greg, we want to make sure you don't win again. If you make the last nine, we're going to decrease you. In other words, it wasn't like it was being done to hinder or benefit certain players. And there's lots of things like that, you know, happen that it might be an advantage or a disadvantage for somebody, but it isn't being done for that purpose. It's just a coincidence.
You think it's better for poker?
Well, I think it's if you get higher TV ratings, then that makes it better for poker. The more people that see it on TV, the more people will be interested and be playing. And overall, the more people participating, the better that is for poker.
Now, you're involved in lobbying, I forgot the name of the organization, but to try to get online poker back legalized, what do you think the chances are given the new administration?
Well, I'm on the board of directors for the Poker Players Alliance, and we are the primary advocacy group that are trying to protect the rights of poker players, and we work both for online poker and live poker. So the chances of getting like a federal bill passed to make online poker like regulated, legalized on a national level, those chances have faded significantly and look close to impossible at this point. So we've got the three states that we mentioned before. We got Nevada, New Jersey, and Delaware. And it's looking quite good at the moment for Pennsylvania and Michigan and some others maybe to join those states as individual states with legalized, regulated online poker. But that really is the only path forward that's clear at the moment is state by state. And that's unfortunate because if a federal bill had gotten passed, it always was going to at least have a provision for states to opt out. And places like Utah definitely would have done so. And they would have said, yes, we're out of this. You know, so whatever the mechanism is, maybe it's like, okay, if your state legislator votes to opt out, you know, then we will opt out of your state and we will require the licensed sites that we are regulating to use geolocation and prevent anyone physically present in your state from playing on the site. And plenty of states might have opted out, but like where I live and for many states, you know, like here in North Carolina, it's kind of a Bible Belt state. I don't know that the legislature would have gone to the effort of opting out, you know, that someone would have introduced the bill basically saying, hey, we want to opt out of this new federal legislation. You know, if a majority of us vote yes, then we have opted out. I don't know that anyone would have really thought it important to make the effort to do that. Whereas right now, for there to be legal regulated online poker in North Carolina, someone's going to have to propose a piece of legislation and get it passed. So people who are actively trying to make it happen, they face that kickback, you know, that the conservative Christian groups are going to come and oppose them and try to get them kicked out of office, you know, voted out in the next election. So there's a big reason for many politicians not to make the active effort to make online poker happen. But if they just didn't actively oppose it, there wouldn't be any downside, really. So I think there's going to be quite a few states like mine that, you know, in the foreseeable future, you don't see any great chance of them ever having online poker.
We've been talking to Greg Raymer. We have lots more questions for Greg. We're going to take a few commercials first, and then we'll be back to Greg Raymer. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In March, the major promotion will be for players who already have slot club cards and receive mailers. Instead of collecting your usual mailers once a week from Tuesday to Thursday, this month you collect it twice, from Monday through Wednesday, and if you do that, you get another one on Friday or Saturday. If you collect all 8 mailers, you get a double the amount free play pickup on Monday, April 3rd. Instead of the normal 4 free play pickups, in March, you get 2.5 times that amount and a total of 9 pickups. They have this variation. They have a variation as promotion once or twice a year. It's a good reason to play at the South Point. The 8th class in the current 10-week semester of free video poker classes will be held on Wednesday, March 15th at noon in the Silverado Lounge. This lounge is right outside Don Vito's restaurant. The class is Advanced NSU Deuces Wild. NSU is a 99.73 variation of the game, which is very slightly positive 24/7 at the South Point because they have a 0.30 slot club. An advanced class covers such things as flush penalties, straight penalties, and since this is a deuces wild game, power of the pack considerations, which are opposite of penalty card considerations. Even if NSU isn't the game you normally play, an understanding of penalty card types is valuable information for strong players. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Magic Card. Magic Card is a 10 coin per line game where periodically you get 1, 2, or 3, very rarely, magic cards. These cards turn into whatever gives you the best hand after the draw. It's somewhat similar to Dream Card, except in Dream Card you only get one card, and it's determined before the draw, not after. There's currently a thread on the Wizard of Vegas site, begun by Michael Shackelford, and it deals with how to analyze this game. For those of you interested in tackling it, you might want to check out that thread. All right, we're talking to Greg Raymer. My next question is Tag Team No Limit Hold'em. Last year at the World Series, they introduced a $1,000 buy-in tag team event. It was popular, and this year they're doing it again, along with a $10,000 tag team. Did you participate in it? What do you think about it?
I didn't participate in it. I have no problem with it. If people enjoy it and want to do it, great for them. But it just didn't appeal to me personally. I would really only want to play in it probably if it had different rules in terms of participation from all the members. The way they have it set up, you can have 2 to 4 people on a team, and I think each player of the team has to play like one orbit around the table, and that's it. So in many cases, these teams are really one person doing almost all the play, the other people do the minimum amount, and maybe they step up like, oh, I want to use the men's room and I don't want to wait for the next break, so come play a couple of hands while I run to the toilet. You know, I've played team events in the past that are more like, oh, every half hour you must switch partners, things like that. So to me, it just seems kind of, you know, like, why are we having it, calling it a team event if it could be that one person, you know, like the winning team at the end with the bracelet, it might be that one person played, you know, 98, 99% of the time. So how does that make it a team play, you know?
Yeah, the whole concept doesn't really make much sense to me.
But apparently it was popular enough to have it again at the bigger stakes, so...
Well, I can easily see, you know, in bridge, there are top players that get paid to play with guys who are not so top players. And, you know, in backgammon, they have doubles where that happens as well. So I can see where this would be popular, where lesser players can, you know, pay to have great partners, and the partners get, you know, equity because maybe their entry fee is paid by somebody else. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I mean, it might make sense for me to participate in that sense. That, like I said, if it's the one, two, or three people who are my partners, and that, like, let's say the three of them put up all the money, and they agree to it, even split 25% each, and I'm like, okay, I'm free rolling this, and they're going to put in the minimum amount of play, and then I'm going to, you know, their plan is that I'm going to do most of the work to win them a bracelet. But, you know, again, if a guy played one orbit out of a 3-day event, you know, so we're talking, you know, so there might have been almost 100 case, orbits or more.
In that would all four players get a bracelet?
Yes, they do.
They all get a bracelet, and there's nothing in the bracelet. And then the prize money, it depends, like, when you sign up for the event. So let's say it's the $10,000 event. If when you sign up for the event, if someone hands them $10,000 and gives their ID or their player card and that's it, then all the money is going to get paid to that one person. And it's up to them and their teammates to split it up, you know, according to whatever they agreed on. But that would be the funny thing, too, is you could essentially rip off your team. Like, oh, we've agreed to split it 25% each. You know, the three of you handed me the cash. I went and signed up and used only my card. You guys only handed your card for purposes of registration, but we didn't tell them to associate any of the money with your card on the buy-in stage. Then when we win the whole thing, and let's say it's $1 million, they're going to hand me $1 million, and the paperwork, like the IRS paperwork, the W-2G, is going to have my name on it for $1 million. And technically, I owe you guys $250,000 each. But what's to stop me from just saying, oh, you know, I did all the play anyways, you guys don't get anything?
What's to stop you?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you guys are going to have to sue me, you know, or
yeah, I'm sure card player wouldn't find that worth talking about, or
of course. I mean, but
yeah,
I'm just
but
saying,
there are a lot of it's poker a matter players of trust. Who wouldn't care if their reputation got. I mean, there are a lot of poker players with very bad reputations already that owe everybody in town money. So,
I mean, you could imagine something too, like, you know, they have the one table satellites over there all the time at the World Series. And they don't pay you cash for those. They pay you in lammers. And a lammer is a chip. It looks like a casino chip, but is only useful for buying into a tournament. It cannot be cashed or used for any other purpose. And so now, you know, you and I just happen to be two strangers. We're playing at this one table sit and go. We're the last two people. We start talking about making a deal. And, you know, you've got 60% of the chips right now, and you said, hey, why don't we do this? I've wanted to play that Paris tournament. Why don't you and I go play as partners, and we'll split the prize money 60-40? And I say, okay. But again, when they pay out a one-table satellite, they don't come over and say, oh, you guys agreed 60-40 and give you 60 and 40. They take down one name and put that in their records, and that person is given the whole 10,000 in lammers. So now they give you the 10,000 in lammers. You and I walk to the cage and we sign up for the Paris tournament, or the, you know, the partners tournament. And our agreement is 60-40. But, like, only you and I know that.
Right.
And I play my one orbit or more, even if I actually put in a lot of the time. when we go to cash out, because it was your name on the cash, they're going to give you all the money. And now you tell me like, yeah, you know, I deserved more. I'm only, you know, I'll give you $100,000, but I'm not giving you any more than that because I don't think you deserve any more because I did most of the playing. And it's like, hey, that wasn't the deal. You know, the deal was 60-40, no matter who played how much. And so it's my word against your word.
Are these arguments come up a lot at the World Series currently? I mean, not just partner events, but just this kind of problem.
They don't come up a lot, but, you know, when they do, they can be serious. There was an incident maybe 2 years ago, give or take. They have what they call the Daily Deep Stack tournaments. They do several of those a day. And the one that starts at 3 p.m. is like $235, and it can get really huge fields. First prize in that tournament has been, you know, 50, 60,000 on occasion. And it starts at 3 p.m., and it will last until 7, 8, 9 in the morning if there's no deal. And one time they got down to either 6 or 7 people. They made a deal for all the money. You know, so the floor is like, okay, great. Well, who's officially first? Who's second? And so on. But these guys have made their agreement as to how much money everyone's going to get. And the guy who is now signing for first, and yeah, he's putting his name down, and for tax purposes, he has to overcome that difficulty. But so he's getting $45,000 for first, but maybe he's only supposed to actually get $20,000 or whatever. I don't know what the deal was exactly. And he goes off to get paid, and then when they're giving him the money, he's like, ask them, you know, can I get a security escort to my car? And he just has like 2 Rio security guards take him to his car, and he stiffs the other 5, 6 people. Yeah. And then it's like, well, what do we do? Like, what are we going to, like, you know, get and go to jail for assaulting security guards? You know, so you're kind of in a tough spot. Now, personally, I'm like, okay, this is legally theft, and I've now got like 4 or 5 other people with me that are witnesses. If this were to go to court, we're probably going to be believed over this one guy. But I'm like, technically what he's doing is taking my money. So certainly, you know, like if someone were to come up to you, you had your wallet out in your hand because you're about to, like, let's say, pay the cashier to enter a tournament. Some guy snatches the wallet out of your hand and starts running. If you were to chase after him, catch up to him, tackle him, and physically take your wallet back, you're not going to be guilty of any crime. I mean, you know, even though you're the one who made it physical, it's like you were protecting your personal property and taking it back from a thief. If you knocked him down, took your wallet, you know, and then when he went to run away, you let him go, you're not guilty of a crime. Now, if you knock him down, take your wallet back, and then proceed to, like, beat him half to death, now you're going to be guilty of assault. Because it's like, hey, look, you didn't need to do that anymore. You'd already protected your property successfully. You didn't need to continue hitting him. But I'm thinking, like, this guy effectively did the same thing. It's just that instead of taking it out of my hand, he didn't give me what he owed me. I would have told the security guards, okay, look, you guys might want to call the police now, because if that guy starts to leave the building with my money and our money pointing to the other people, I'm going to physically stop him from doing so. And I'm legally entitled to you know, be physical with him to protect my property. And if you guys feel like you have to get involved, now you're interfering with my legal right to protect my property. And now I am legally entitled to do whatever I have to physically prevent you from doing that. And I don't want to hurt you, and I don't want to hit you, and I don't want any of us to go to jail. So you might want to, instead of escorting this guy out, you might want to just call the cops now, and we'll avoid all the physical stuff and let the cops settle this.
Yeah.
And now the police, when they are hearing all these different stories, they're going to be like, we don't know who to believe. Let's just take all the cash and pound it and let a judge decide who gets what. Now I have a much better chance of getting the money that's owed to me at that point. And so, you know, and if the security guards are halfway decently trained, they're going to be like, you know, it's not like I'm just running up and jumping the guy. I'm politely telling them, like, look, this is what this guy is doing. He's stealing from us. I'm not going to let him get away with it. You know, you better call the police. They're going to call their supervisor, and their supervisor is going to call the cops, and the Las Vegas police are going to show up, and this guy's not going to be able to physically leave. So that's would be the way to handle it, maybe. But the truth is, you should never make a deal with someone if you don't trust them enough.
It's probably clear to our listeners that you went to law school, practiced law for a while. Several other prominent poker players did that. Andy Block was one. Vanessa Selps passed law school. Do you miss it? Do you ever think you're going back to practicing law?
I'm going to be doing some law right now, actually. So I quit practicing as an attorney when I won the main event. It was a very easy decision. PokerStars was offering me more money to represent them than Pfizer was paying me to be an attorney. So it was like, oh, okay, I can travel the world and play poker and make a lot more money, or I can turn down that offer and stay here and work full-time as an attorney. So it was an easy decision to make more money and travel the world and play poker. But I don't travel as much as I used to. I don't travel internationally. And it also used to be like, well, when I'm not traveling, I'm at home and I have a wife and a daughter, and that's when I get to spend time with them. But now my daughter's in college. My wife is planning on going back to work full time. She's just trying to figure out what she wants to do. And so that means when I'm home, it's not like I'll be able to spend time with them. You know, my wife will be busy and my daughter's not here. So might as well do something useful as well as interesting to fill the time. So I'm getting back into patent law and looking for some like part-time work. So I'm talking to patent attorneys, you know, that I know and other patent attorneys in the area. And it's kind of like, hey, you know, if you have need of someone to like draft a patent application, you know, here's an option for you. I can do it and I can give you a much better price than hiring someone at a law firm, because I don't have to cover all that overhead of an office and a secretary and all that.
Interesting. Being a patent attorney strikes me as much fun as being an actuary, I guess.
Not really. I mean, by definition, if you have something patentable, that means it's new. It's never been done before. So it's brand new technology invented by you. And if it isn't, you know, new cutting edge stuff, then my job would be to advise you that you're wasting your time trying to get a patent on it. So by definition, what I'm working with is the newest cutting edge stuff in my area. So it's very interesting, because it's always like, wow, that's cool. You just came up with a solution to this problem or a new solution, you know, better solution to a problem. So it's actually very interesting stuff.
Well, good. I'm glad you think about your career that way.
No, actually, you know what? When you say it that way, that makes sense. You know, I haven't thought of that, but when you say that, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, my client comes to me and they have an invention, and they're usually people who work in that field, so they know better than me even if it's new. You know, I'm going to have to go dig into things a while maybe before I'm going to understand why it's new. But, you know, if they're full-time scientists in that area, then they know the science better than I do. But they come to me and they explain this great new thing, and then I'm drafting it, putting it in the form of a patent application and helping them get a patent from the patent office for it. So basically I get to learn about something brand new that never existed before most of the rest of the world does. And, you know, so I mean, yeah, if you're not that interested in science and technology, but I mean, compare it to something like playing video poker. I mean, how new is anything in video poker?
Well, I got two paired. I can play it. But you're right. I get a lot of those. Point taken.
You know, I mean, that doesn't mean you can't enjoy it and love it. It's just,
that's true.
There's going to be plenty of people, though, who are intellectually capable of being winning video poker players who are going to be like, this is boring as hell. Like, I don't want to do this.
Yes.
So it's all subjective. It's personal preference. And if, you know, if you're an actuary, if you're an accountant, it's like, yeah, of course it's different every time. It's a different client. The numbers aren't the same, but a lot of it, you know, it's essentially the same thing with some different numbers this time, but you're still filling out this tax form for your client and you're inputting this type of data. You know, the fact that it's not 100% identical to the one you did for the last client doesn't mean that it isn't substantially the same.
Tell us about Share My Pair.
Yeah, ShareMyPair is an app. I work with those people, and it's free. You can download it on your Android or your iPhone. And it's a way of basically creating an animated hand history video. So people might be familiar. If they play online poker, there are things called hand replayers. Most of the sites where you would play online poker, you can have them email you your hand histories. And those are essentially text documents that you get in your email that spell out the details of the hand. And, you know, as soon as a site sets the format for which they're going to type up that information when they send it to you in the email, then someone will have a hand replayer that will parse that document and convert it into a hand history that plays on the replayer. And it looks similar to what you might see when you're playing online poker. So it would be as if you were watching someone else play the hand replayer, because it's taken the information. It has the names of the players, the starting stacks, the blinds, who's got the button, all that information, all the cards that are dealt. And it will show you the little graphic video on your computer screen as if you were watching the hand play in real time when you played it on the online poker site. And the hand replayer just recreates that, in a sense. Well, ShareMyPair is the same idea, but instead of taking what was emailed to you from an online site, you input the data yourself. So it's more intended for a live game replication. So when I play a hand live, there's no hand history to be downloaded. There's no way I can have that data sent to me in any digital form. So instead, I will input it myself. So I open the app on my phone and I tell it it's a cash game or a tournament. What are the blinds? You know, I click a seat. Where am I sitting? I click another seat. Where is the button at? I input whatever data I want. So if I say that there are eight people at the table, then fine, there's eight people at the table. But I don't have to input stack size for all eight positions or a name or a description for each seat if I don't want to. But maybe it was, you know, the three of us, you know, that played the hand against each other. So, you know, I'm in seat one and, you know, here's my information. And then here's Richard in seat four and here's Bob in seat seven. And I input your stack sizes as I best estimate them. And then I'm inputting my cards, the betting action, the cards of yours that I get to see, the cards that are on the board. And now I have this little video that I can then share with other people. So when the guys who developed this company started, they thought, okay, we think this will be something people will like to use. And it's mostly going to be people sharing their bad beat stories with their friends. So it's like, instead of having to like call Bob up on the phone and say, oh my God, Bob, you wouldn't believe this bad beat I took and tell you the story, I can just email you or I can send out a tweet with a link to the hand history that you can then look at. And then when you do this, the hand also, there's a chat thread under the hand. So now people can say things to you. Oh, tough beat, Bob. You know, that was an unlucky river card. Or they can say, well, you know, you took a bad beat on the river, but your pre-flop play was horrible, Bob. Here's why. And that's the thing. It's turned out that more and more people use ShareMyPair as a teaching tool. So, and there's me and lots of other pros that work with ShareMyPair. So if you were on ShareMyPair, let's say you played a hand in a cash game today and you thought like, wow, I really wasn't sure if I should fold or not when this guy check raised the flop, you could put that hand history up. And then when you tweet it, maybe you include me at Fossilman or you include Jonathan Little or one of the other pros on ShareMyPair. And, you know, I'll see it in my at mentions feed on Twitter and maybe I will open it up and I might comment on your hand and say, you know, okay, yeah, Bob, this was a close decision. So either way, no big deal. Or I might say, oh, no, this is clearly, in my opinion, a fold, or this is clearly a call or whatever. You know, I give you my feedback. And so whether you're getting feedback from a ShareMyPair pro or whether it's just your friends, it's now a way that you can help improve your game.
Very okay. Cool. And free. We love free.
And free means there's probably ads on it to help pay yeah, for the pros.
The ad is basically like, you know, when you go to the World Series, you know, you'll see in the middle of the felt like World Series of Poker. And that's the same kind of thing here. On that graphic in the middle of the table, there is the logo for somebody.
Yeah.
So right? it's not like it's intrusive. It's not like you don't have to like watch a 10-second video ad before the hand video plays. That's not how it works. You'll just see, you know, the logo in the middle of the table for World Series of Poker or for whatever company is buying that space.
Very good.
Very easy to ignore if you're not interested.
Tell us about Ustake.com.
Yeah, Ustake is a company I work with. And what this is for is allowing people to stake poker players. I mean, staking is very common in the poker world. But usually it is handled either privately because people are just communicating, you know, with their friends, you know, on a phone call and a text message, in an email. There are some platforms out there, like there's a staking forum on 2+2, which is the main poker discussion website. So people will go to that staking forum and they will say, hey, I'm looking for people to buy some of my action in this tournament or in this cash game or whatever, and it's online games or live games. And people, you know, can respond, but it's up to them to transfer the money back and forth. So if I were to stake you through one of those means, and I'm sending you money by PayPal or by bank wire or whatever method it is that I'm moving the money to you, and you go off and play the game, it is, again, purely on trust for you to pay me what you owe me when you win. And, you know, so obviously sometimes it doesn't work out well. On Ustake, the idea is, instead of like me and also me having to manage this, like I sell action for the entire year. So I have a group of people that have bought a portion of my action for every poker game I play this entire calendar year. But obviously I don't want to be selling this in $20 increments because then I'm going to have, you know, 1,000 or more people that I have to deal with and keep straight. Whereas on Ustake, now Ustake is handling it. So when the people who are investing, they put the money onto Ustake. My situation is very unique, this full year deal. Most of the time it is one specific live tournament. So let's say that you're going to play the 888 tournament at the World Series of Poker, $888 buy-in, and you are looking to sell half of your action at face value. So you're telling to someone, you know, I'm selling up to $444 of my action and you will get half of whatever I win. So to make it easy, I'm the one and only guy who buys any of your action on Ustake. Well, I have the money on Ustake. When you go to register, Ustake will either have a representative there in person, or in the future, what Ustake wants to do is fully establish relationships with all the poker rooms where they can just wire the money to the poker room and put names and tournaments, you know, for each of the dollars that's being sent. So now it says that Bob Dancer has $440 in WSOP event number. I don't know the number for that event, so we'll just call it event number 8. And then when you show up at the cage, you show them your ID and your player's card, and you tell them, I have Ustake money. And they'll say, okay, yep, here it is, $444. You owe us the other $444. So now you hand them the other $444. You're registered for the tournament. They give you your receipt that has your table number. You go play the event. Oh, and now you cash for $20,000. Well, now when you go to get paid, they're looking your name up in the computer, and it's like, oh, yeah, Ustake, you know, had half your action. We're only going to give you $10,000, Bob, and then here's the W2G for $10,000. And we're going to send the other $10,000 to Ustake, who's going to send it to your investors. And so, Ustake will then generate any necessary tax paperwork for each of those investors.
So do they currently have that relationship with the WSOP? So,
well, at the moment, Ustake actually isn't operating. And because they are seeking full approval from FINRA, the, you know, financial thing.
Yeah.
And so while they are in the process of obtaining approval, they have to, like, not do business. So at the moment, you can't use Ustake. But hopefully that process will be completed soon and we'll be back in business. And then it's just a question of convincing all the poker rooms that they want to operate in this fashion. Now, instead, what happens, like the first year of operation, they did not have that relationship with the Rio and the World Series, but they have lots and lots of these events happening for the World Series. So let's say, again, you've sold half your action. What they do is they would actually have a guy physically there in person, and you would arrange to meet him at the cage at a certain time when you were going to register for the tournament, and he would have the cash, and he would give half to the cashier, and you'd give your half. And then when you, if you made the money, they made it a point to be there in the cashier cage, so you could just easily give them the half that goes back to the U-Stake investor. Now, at that point, though, if you just said, like, hey, screw you, I'm not giving you the money, it's not like they can do anything about it. But now they have all the information, and they have all the records, and they have all the evidence and proof to go to the police and say, this guy stole $10,000.
Right. I mean, that's why it would solve that problem. If they have this relationship, that would make it a great thing. Do they charge for this service once it's up and running?
It's a 5% fee for the investor. So in this case, again, well, let's just change the numbers to make the math easier. You're buying $1,000 worth of my action in a tournament at par. So you get, you know, if it's a 10K event, you're getting 10% of whatever I win for a $1,000 investment. You're going to have to pay $1,050 to U-Stake, because they're keeping that 5% as a fee. That's how they make their money. That's how they stay in business and operate. A lot of people also sell at a markup. So maybe I'm charging a 1.2 markup. So for 10% of my action, you have to pay $1,200. Well, now you have to pay $1,200 plus the 5%. So, well, it's not 60, it's still actually 50. It's based on the 1,000 in equity that you're getting. So I think that's correct. I guess I shouldn't say that with 100% certainty, but I think you'd pay $1,250 instead of $1,200.
If they solve this problem of knowing that you're going to get paid and the handling of the tax forms, which is, you know, kind of a big deal too, I can see that as a very worthwhile thing.
Yeah, I mean, except there is this fee involved, and if you're doing business directly between player and investor, you don't have that fee. But now it has to be someone you trust, and the tax issue is still there. I mean, if I win the main event this summer, you know, this year, and I'm getting paid $8 million, I have this deal with all these people, but, you know, when the Rio is handing me the money, it's just going to say W2G 8 million Greg Raymer. Now I'm going to have to, you know, go to the effort of explaining to the IRS that no, it's really these 20 individuals who each get this cut of the money.
Do you 1099 all of them? Is that how you deal with that?
I'm not sure what's the best way, but I mean, it was a little different. Fortunately, I mean, I had people who had pieces on me when I won the main event in 04 as well. And what ended up happening there was Binion's was just willing. I mean, I got paid. And then when I went back to them, you know, they were willing to, like, essentially issue new. In other words, they sent the retraction to the IRS for the original W-2G. They gave me a new one for my number. And then they gave out new ones to each of the individuals, and we paid them.
Wow, that's that.
But
that,
I had.
Was
I,
that back I, when Jack Binion still had it?
No, Becky was basically in charge at that time. But the thing is, I had documents from each person that were notarized saying that, yes, they were acknowledging that, you know, for each person, how much of it was theirs.
If you were willing to do that.
Well, and I tell people, you know, up front, like, again, everyone who invested this year, I've told them, like, if we win enough that there's, you know, tax paperwork needed, then I might be requiring you to do this kind of a thing before I pay you your money. And like back in 04, I even had like a couple of people that were outside the U.S. And so it was like, oh, here's a guy, he gets $72,000, but he's in Poland. I mean, if he had been here in the U.S. and had won the money himself, they would have withheld 30%, given it to the IRS with his name.
Right.
And then he's going to have to file like a tax return to get it back. So I withheld 30% from his money, sent it to the IRS, and told him, like, you potentially can get all or some of that back depending upon the other income you have for the year. But, you know, and I had told them in advance, like, this is what could happen. So same thing now. If we do well enough this year and that's an issue, then they will, you know, maybe have to send me again, like, a notarized document or whatever, you know. I'll ask a tax attorney or an accountant, you know, the best way to do it now in 2017. But yeah, we will issue the necessary paperwork so I don't have to pay taxes on their money, and they know before they invested that this could happen. They would, you know, and I told them, like, don't hide it. I mean, even if it doesn't rise to that level, I mean, even at the end of the year, if you invested $1,000 in me and I'm paying you back your $1,000 plus a $300 profit, that would mean that's $300 profit I didn't actually make that records might indicate I had. And I'll be telling the IRS exactly what happened. Like, no, I didn't make that much. I made this much. And here's why, because I sent $300 to him and $600 to him and so on. And I have your name and all that, your address and stuff. So, you know, don't invest in me if you're planning on hiding it, if it's a small win, because I might be telling the IRS your name along with every other investor so they'll know where the money went. And then when they look at your return, they're like, well, you know, hey, Bob, where's that $300? Rich, where's that $600? We don't see any mention of that in your return.
Very good. We've been talking to Greg Raymer. It's been very interesting. It's a longer than average show. It's very fascinating all the way. Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit a royal flush, everybody. Good day.